Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hernan Coleman is a creative director in Northern California. His evolution from, as he puts it, science geek kid to credulous New Ager to become an advocate for critical thinking and scientific skepticism is a work in progress. It was great to speak with him, and I look forward to having you hear our interesting and powerful and personal and offbeat and what I think is timely discussion. Here's Kernan now.
So I really want to welcome Kernan to the podcast. I actually reached out to him because we are connected to each other through social media and we know a lot of the same people. But I just think that he has a lot of life wisdom and insights. And I really love also the way he turns a phrase. And so I thought it would be really good and insightful and also fun to have a conversation with him on the podcast. So welcome, Kernan.
Thank you, Rachel. Good to be here.
Good. I'm glad. So far, so good then, right?
It is.
So would you mind just taking a moment to introduce yourself?
My name is Kernan Coleman. I am a branding and graphic design professional up in Santa Rosa, California. And I am a... Oh, what else am I? My areas of interest are science, critical thinking, cults, mind control, why we believe what we believe, having been around almost 60 years now. I'm pretty fascinated by what I believe and why I believe it.
So right in line with this podcast, of course. And so no wonder I wanted to talk to you. And that's a great list. What people are usually interested in to begin with, and I'm always interested in to begin with, is what drew you to these subjects as much as you feel comfortable sharing with the audience. But I'm always interested to see why people care about what they care about in this way.
Well, I started out as a very geeky science kid back in the 60s. My father was a hardcore atheist. A humanist, very much a compassionate, larger-than-life character. And my mom is lovely, beautiful. She was a model in New York in the 1940s and 50s. And she wasn't necessarily an atheist or a skeptic, but she wasn't particularly religious either. She liked to delve into a lot of different sorts of spiritual and seeking kinds of books. So I had the influence of two parents who were very intellectual. They loved art and music and science, and they really encouraged me to explore the world as much as I wanted to, and I did. And was very much a science-oriented kind of snarky, combative child. And then I kind of veered off into I would say pseudoscience and new agey kind of quantum abuse, you know, abusing quantum physics and all that when I was in my late teens.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't really think about it. It was just sort of seemed like a natural deviation for me, because I've always been a very ambivalent person. And when I say ambivalent, people usually think that means, oh, you don't care. No, it means you care a lot, but you care, you can kind of care about two things at once, and they could be opposites.
Yeah.
So I was a very creative kid. I was an actor. I was on stage from the time I was six until I was in my 20s, and an artist, but also passionate about science, space, all that kind of stuff. However, also fascinated by ghosts and monsters and cryptids. And, you know, as a kid, I wanted all that stuff to be true. And even as an adult, I still kind of want that stuff to be true, but I was not a good critical thinker. And that's something that I'm pretty passionate about, is teaching critical thinking to children from a very early age, because I believe children are natural born scientists. They come out of the womb. They're not religious when they come out of the womb. They're curious. We are the most insatiably curious creatures. And so I love watching little kids go all, you know, they go all scientist on stuff. How does this work? What happens if I drop it? What happens if I flush my $40 orthopedic shoe down the toilet? You know, whatever it is. Kids are just constantly doing stuff. Sometimes it puts them, you know, I burned my hand on the stove because I was like, oh, it's red. I learned that lesson. Experiment successful.
Experiment successful. Painful and successful. Right. There is something about how, you know, when kids ask why a lot. And I know parents, caregivers of any sort get really tired of hearing the question, but it is the ultimate question.
Yeah.
And so that's so much about what you're saying about being the scientist. Why is it like that? Why does it happen that way? And I think it's a fantastic question. It's also interesting you're talking about ghosts, because there's someone I know who worked on one of these shows, these ghost shows.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying that there were so many outtakes because they would hear something. And someone would say, oh, it sounds like someone is from another dimension saying haunted. And then the sound guy would go, no, that's just like the lunch guy saying hot dog.
I think those shows should be called, what was that? Because that's all it is. That's all they do. And why do ghosts only come out at night? Why is that? Right? Wouldn't they be around all the time? Yeah. I mean, why do they always have to go to haunted houses at night? Yeah, it's kind of annoying. However, don't get me wrong. As a child, I was absolutely obsessed with ghosts and witches and monsters and things like that. And I thought they were so cool. I loved being scared of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And imagining that, you know, I would live forever. And there's a thing when children discover death. Mm. And that's a big moment. You know, Sparky the cat dies or grandma dies or something. And then all of a sudden, oh, where'd they go? What happened to them? Why are they not moving? Why is Sparky so still? You know, all of that stuff. And it depends on when that happens.
Yeah.
It was so getting to like my veering off into New Agery and things like that. That was not handled really well with me. My parents were a lot older. They were 45 and 35 when I was born, and they always treated me like a small adult, but they also didn't really understand anxiety, I think, especially existential anxiety. Mm-hmm. And that stuff sets in early.
Yeah.
And you know, I was just a kind of a good, easy kid. So, you know, I wasn't running around like freaking out about stuff. Plus no one died in my family until I was like 13.
Mm-hmm.
So even the dog didn't die till I was 21. So,
really? Oh, you're so lucky.
I had a 17-year-old dog die when I was 20, wow. 20, 21.
Wow.
So that wasn't like a thing. I mean, a goldfish died and I was just like, yeah, whatever. but it was, it was gnawing at me. And my my parents were very sort of, they were sort of weird around it. They wouldn't talk about it when people died. There was my friend's father died when I was about six, and they were like, do you want to go to the funeral? And I was like, I don't know, it's weird. And it freaked me out, and they didn't make me go. And I, to this day, I wish they had, because my friends were my two sisters, who were really friends of mine and are still friends of mine to this day, I think it hurt them that I didn't go. And it set up a sort of a otherness about death.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, the grim fairy tales when you were a child in the Middle Ages, everyone died all the time. You lost siblings, one, two, people died in your village, whole villages died of the plague. It was like built into the mythology for children because you're going to have to face it. So,
right. It's very true. And you're right. Those existential questions do set in at an early age and they affect people in different ways. And I think that just the notion of not existing.
Oh, yeah.
That our brain cannot kind of wrap itself around, especially at a young age, especially when you're having this kind of innocence about life mm-hmm. and just sort of taking in your day and what are yep. you going to do later? And that's sort of all that's on your mind about, like, you know, what game you're going to be able to play or the new bike or whatever else. And so to just suddenly think about not being is more than, I think, more than most adults also can.
It still offends me. I find it very offensive. From an egoic standpoint, it's just offensive. No. I need to fly around and see the solar system after I die and visit with all my cool friends and meet people I've always wanted to meet. And
right.
Yeah, it's that for me was a thing that set in this gnawing existential angst. For me, veering off into New Agery, channeling and afterlife experiences mm-hmm. was soothing to me. Mm-hmm. It's like, yes, everything will be okay. I'll reincarnate. I'll have an afterlife experience and I'll, you know, choose a new life and all of that stuff that that kind of like New Agey stuff. I remember there's something they do a lot in New Thought and New Age, which is you create your own reality. And it's actually horrific victim blaming in reality. What it really is victim blaming. So if you create your own reality and you're well, you're not sick, you're the worried well, which I definitely was at the time, because mm-hmm. Alt-Med was a big part of my New Age experience. And my partner at the time was very into that. So it was great. Thousands and thousands of dollars spent on very expensive pee in terms of homeopathy and wow. supplements and okay. Reiki and acupuncture and you name it. Anyway, to get back to what I was saying, for me, it was very soothing to have this sort of afterlife. And then I tried, because I was still skeptical and still a science-based person, I was very much drawn toward Fritjof Capra and the quantum woo meisters like Deepak Chopra and stuff like that, who would take quantum physics and sort of abuse it until it fit their worldview. Because quantum physics is so weird and so incomprehensible to our macro, you know, humans, that a scientist who tries to, you know, scientists can even have their own cognitive biases and see what they want in that, I think. So I was very into all that for a long time.
And, you know, just to say that's what a lot of people talk to me about, that was the draw, that they wanted to be able to have the answers to the unanswerable. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to be able to feel confident and be able to envision and be able to answer why. And it's very relieving. And I know that even though I'm not necessarily believing in a particular way, I might at a different time if I'm needing that. And I think being able to have it be fluid, if that's what you're needing in your life at that time, I think is an important thing. It's just, it seems to be problematic when you adhere to a particular belief system that tells you that you have to believe that way or else. And so, I mean, that's part of the reason that I do this work.
Right. Well, especially if there's an or else.
Right.
For me, it was, like I said, pretty much anxiety driven. And the seeking, I think, is very normal in humans. And the anxiety about death is very normal. And it would take me like a good 15 years from, I don't know, let's see, when was that I really started veering off? It was like 1980 that I started veering into that stuff. And it really wouldn't be until 1996 that I started a 10-year process of all of that falling away. And it was, I had started to work for a sort of new age dog and pony show called Whole Life Expo, and doing branding and graphics. And I was very into it, but it's funny in retrospect. Some stuff I would totally buy, and then other stuff I'd be like, oh, well, that's so stupid. Why would anybody believe that? And not want to even examine my own cognitive biases and my own my own blinkers that would be like, la, 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 la. I'd see Carl Sagan and I would just be like, no, don't melt my snowman. I kind of hated Carl Sagan because he scared me, because I kind of knew inside that he was probably right, but he was trying to melt my snowman and I didn't like that. And I still will say, hating Carl Sagan is like hating puppies. So, you know, it's in retrospect, it's kind of hilarious.
But it's interesting about the Whole Life Expo. I know it's very popular and a lot of people go and a lot of people, peddle their stuff there. And there are some things that are probably fine and some things that are not at all, but it's all there for anyone to consume or believe. And so part of the challenge, of course, becomes how to differentiate and what questions to ask and what to find out before you buy.
Right. Well, or is there a body count involved in it? Are they trying to tell you to not take your meds? Are they trying to tell you that you can just throw away your, insulin or something like that? And there's a lot of that out there. And for me, when I say there was a 10-year period, the 10-year period was marked by two deaths: the death of my best friend from AIDS in 1996. And the death of my sister from recurrent lung cancer in 2006. So it was a 10-year period. Working for Whole Life Expo began to scrape all of the barnacles off my hull of magical thinking, because I ended up seeing these people's behavior and seeing that they were just like everyone else: egoic, petty, greedy, sometimes funny, sometimes. I'd see them in the green room, or I'd see them at cocktail parties, or I'd see them and just be like, no, these people don't have any answers. But it took me a long time to kind of figure that out. I will not name names and incidents, but there were plenty of them over the years that I worked with that company. I'm grateful for it. I'm super grateful for those years. Because I met a lot of great people as well, and people who I'm still friends with, people who I still work with. From the creative team I created for them, and who I still work with to this day. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was, as I said, it was the death of my friend Paul in 2006 from AIDS. And he and I were both very spiritual thinkers, and he was a channeler. I really believed he was psychic. I truly believed he was psychic. He was intuitive and super smart. He was a very, very smart person. Knew his history, was obsessed with art and history, and really knew his stuff. But he could read tarot and what he said was channeling. What he was hypervigilant, which I believe was from childhood trauma that he was very upfront about. But one of the things he was, AIDS was terrifying back then, because it really was a death sentence in those days. And the people that made it through for a variety of reasons, usually because they just kept throwing drugs at it and they were strong enough physically to survive it. Yeah. And Paul introduced me to someone named Peter Duisberg, who is a molecular biologist at Berkeley, who was worked on the oncogene, which was a gene that he thought caused cancer. He is still a tenured professor at Berkeley, but he is an HIV denialist. He doesn't believe HIV causes AIDS. And we met him. We went to hear him talk. That was what I wanted to hear. I totally fell for it. And Paul totally fell for it. And the tragedy is, you know, I was negative, he was positive. And he didn't even know it at the time. He was just, we were just both fearful of it. And then once he became, once he knew he had seroconverted, my partner and I at the time were friends with him. And, you know, we tried to be supportive and helpful. And I was still totally in alignment with his believing that HIV didn't cause AIDS. And I remember the head of the HIV medicine in Sonoma County begging him, listening. I was sitting in the waiting room. She was practically in tears, begging him to try protease inhibitors. And he just kept calling her the queen of AZT and that stuff's poison. And I didn't doubt it enough. Mm-hmm. And he died with a bag of protease inhibitors an arm's length away. And even then, it still didn't go away. That's how much you can torture reality and rationality and logic if you want something to be true. If something makes you anxious enough, if something is frightening enough. And it's why I have compassion for people who believe in things that have a body count. I understand why people are anti-vaccination. I'm not. I know the vaccines have made people's lives much longer, and it's not a perfect science, but it's pretty darn good science. Logic and all of that shows that, you know, the diseases that once ravaged childhoods vanished after all of the vaccines came on the scene. But I understand what it's like to be so blinkered and so blinded that you will throw your rationality away because of fear. I'm not saying it's okay to do that, but I'm not saying I don't argue with people about it, because I do.
Right.
So Paul's death was the beginning of me starting to go, wow, maybe this isn't all true. Maybe these ideas are not real. And it took me another 10 years of it took me another 10 years of that stuff wearing off of me. The death of my father, he was at 94, very, you know, timely for him. It wasn't like, oh, he died young.
Right.
And he died in a rest home, so I wasn't there. But it was the death of my sister, who was 63 at the time, her cancer that she had had 17 years earlier and had beaten with chemo and radiation, came back, and it came back with a vengeance. And in that 5 weeks from her calling me and saying it's back to her dying, I spent every weekend, I would go up every weekend and visit her and spend the day with her at least every weekend. And her grace, and I'll use that word, her human grace, her acceptance, and the normalcy that she brought to her passing by planning everything, by taking care of all the things that needed to be taken care of, absolutely changed my life. It made my fear of death really went away in those 5 weeks, even though she was dying right in front of me, because the conversations we had, you know, we talked a lot, we cried a lot, we laughed a lot. And the one conversation that changed everything was, she said to me one day, "Do you still believe in that create your own reality crap?" as she said. And I said, "No, I really don't anymore." And she said, "Good, because the one thing you learn when you're facing your own death and you really accept it is that there's only one secret to the universe, and that is shit happens." And it was funny, and we laughed about it, but that bumper sticker phrase was the moment when everything just went, and I was just like, I just didn't need that stuff anymore. It was kind of a weird epiphany,
right,
in that moment. So yeah, that was the end of all that for me. And I came out of the fog with a vengeance into skepticism, atheism, critical thinking, and activism. big time activism as much as I could.
Right. So yeah, I want to ask about that. And first, I just want to remark about, you know, the stories that you just shared. I mean, they're just heartbreaking for different reasons, but also for shared reasons about the loss. And so, yes, during the time of the epidemic, it was extremely frightening.
Yeah.
And scary for so many people for a lot of reasons, but the government wasn't doing what it should and everyone was dragging their feet. And finally, people were able to get some help. And now, you know, when you think about the loss of someone within your family and the way she handled it and how it's affected you and how that whole idea of shit happens, I mean, that is just really calling it as it is. And there's something very open, very honest about that. I think also going back to something that you were saying about the Whole Life Expo, and then I want to come back to the activism that you just mentioned.
Oh, sure.
When you were talking about how some of the people, you know, they could be really honest about what they were doing, and some were just probably snake oil salesmen and women. And some were funny. I'm sure also because I've come across this, there are some who were so serious because of their self-importance or sense of self-importance. Mm-hmm. And that there was no way to kind of question their pseudoscience.
Oh, yeah.
And they're usually very defensive, which I think is also a red flag. I have something on my desk that I'm looking at as we're talking, and I don't know who originally wrote it. So if someone knows, please tell me. It's the quote, I would rather have questions that can't be answered than answers that can't be questioned. And that's sort of a mantra that I have here in my office, especially because of a lot of the population that I work with. But when you are faced with that, with people who are just having all these answers that can't be questioned, it also sets me into wanting to do something about that, because just that kind of air of entitlement, I have it, and you can't touch it, and you can't question it, and you're a lesser being for questioning it. I mean, that lights a fire under me. And so tell me about your activism. What triggered it, and how does that play out in your life?
Well, for me, having woken up and having realized that the HIV denialism killed my friend, and that I was a part of that, even though he introduced me to all of it. You know, I could sit there and question myself and say, oh, well, why didn't you think, you know, why didn't you change then? Why didn't you question it? Why didn't you make him take the drugs? Blah, blah, blah. No, that was not on the cards at the time, so to speak.
Yeah.
No pun intended. No, we were both very into that worldview at the time. With some other friends of ours too, who I hope are all out of it. But the idea that a scientist, someone who was nominated for a Nobel Prize, somebody who was a respected scientist, could do something like that, could influence the president of South Africa into that, you know. They estimate upwards of 300,000 people died that didn't have to die because of HIV denialism, because of Thabo Mbeki believing Duisberg and a dozen other so-called doctors and activists who were utterly convinced that HIV wasn't real because it was too scary. They wanted to believe that garlic or something else would cure you, or it was all just a big mistake. It's like, whoa. That takes some really, really big blinders to do that. And for me, it was the conspiracy that would have to be in place. It was the absolute conspiracy that would have to be in place for that to work. That woke me up a couple of years after Paul died. And I was like, that was one of the things, one of the big scales falling from my eyes. It was like, oh, wow, that's crazy. So when I came out of it all, after my sister passed away, I immediately went to like James Randi and P.Z. Myers and Carl Sagan. I read all the Carl Sagan I could find, all of the great science books that I could find, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, very, very polemic. I was very polemic. I was very angry. I was very like, gung-ho, you're stupid if you believe that. I was like super atheist, super dark, kind of an asshole probably. And I really, really, really was like, oh, I'm gonna do something about this. I can fix you. Which, you know what? I'm glad that I had that drive. I'm glad I had that passion. I have volunteered for a lot of science and free thought and skeptical organizations. And I still work with a lot of them to this day. And I love doing it and I love helping. But I like helping through teaching, helping through kind of showing that life is better on the without magical thinking. Mm-hmm. Not without wonder, not without beauty, not without love and joy and art and all of that, but without magical thinking.
When you were talking about also James Randi, who is someone who not a lot of people have heard of him. I wish more people are aware of his work. He has taught people so much. When you were just talking about magical thinking and his world was magic. And he's quite a character in of himself.
I worked for him for several years.
That's wonderful. And I heard him speak at a number of conferences, and I know the challenge that he's sort of set out. And can you teach our listeners a little bit about James Randi?
Well, James Randi was one of the greatest escape artists of the 20th century. He was a young man in Canada. He was obsessed with Houdini and magic and all of that. He had a pretty rough childhood, from what I remember. There's a very good movie about his life called An Honest Liar. That I did all of the archival photo retouching for and the poster for, by Tyler Meesom. It's a really wonderful documentary, because it's not a hagiography. It's really actually a wonderful film about a really interesting dude. Mm-hmm. And Randi became very, very much a skeptic and very, very much a proponent of rationality and the scientific method. And even though he was a master magician, the first night I ever met him, I was just talking today. I was in San Francisco and I saw him speak at the Jewish Museum in San Francisco. They have a theater there, and they rented that theater, and he gave a talk on critical thinking and magic and stuff. And that was the first night I met him and started working with the James Randi Educational Foundation. And we went to the Slanted Door for dinner, and I sat across the table from him. And he was in his late 80s then, I guess, and had just had cancer therapy for months. And we walked all the way from the Yerba Buena Gardens down to the restaurant. And he talked the whole time. He was like animated and just amazing. And I sat, and he did sleight of hand magic across the table from me. And I could not see how he did it. I was absolutely blown away by that. Wow. And in that moment, he was talking to me and saying, it's like, okay, you know, I can do this in front of a scientist. I can do this in front of the smartest person in the world, and it'll still work on them. They'll even go, well, I don't know how he's doing it, but I still am seeing these things happen. So the idea of the honest liar, someone who is so good at sleight of hand, so good at the con, so good at misdirection, being the person that reveals that to the world, I think is a really neat idea.
Yeah, right. And I think also Penn and Teller have followed in that tradition.
Yeah, very much in his footsteps. They're big fans of his, I know that.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I think that they really love the fact that people can be fooled, but they also really detest the people who are fooling other people in serious ways.
The grief vampires and in our society are I think it's really detestable. Even if they are delusional and they really believe that they're talking to dead people, I feel with Paul, I had this world, this view inside of that phenomenon of someone who truly believed he was communing with other, he was just making it up in his head, and he was really good, and he was really theatrical, and he was really smart, and he convinced himself that he was talking to someone else, that the wisdom that he had came from somewhere else. And the archetypes of the Tarot, those were carefully crafted. Mm-hmm. Those are the human behaviors. That's pretty much, they're brilliant in that respect. Mm-hmm. The Magician, the Hanged Man, the Priestess, the Star, all of those things are things inside of everyone. So when someone cold reads and they're really good at it, and maybe they're hypervigilant and they read you because they're really good at it, because at one time in their life depended on it. I really do believe that now, having known Paul as well as I did,
right,
and having been very much a fan of Jane Roberts, who was a channeler back in the 70s, and really believed her a lot. She was a really remarkable writer, I think, and very creative, and very, she wanted to believe what she was doing was real, because she was suffering from a horrific disease, rheumatoid arthritis, that was almost crippling and agonizingly painful most of her life. Her mother had died from it. She had watched her mother die from it. I think it scared her deeply. And I have enormous compassion for her. She was a creative, really wonderful person, I think. But I think it was kind of delusional in the end. And her story and Paul's story were so similar. Abusive mothers, diseases, psychological effects of PTSD from an abusive mother, hypervigilance, all of that. I'm not saying every single person who claims to be a psychic is that, but I would be surprised if they didn't have a lot of similars in their backgrounds. That's just my uneducated theory. I'm sticking to it.
So going back to this, this subject of magical thinking, or the needs that you have around death and dying and the fears around that. It's interesting. You're reminding me of the time right after my father passed away. Unfortunately, he died in his late 50s and I was 22 at the time. And he's the one who kind of got me interested in this whole realm of critical thinking and all of it. I remember right after he passed away, I was hanging out with a lot of friends who were sort of, you know, keeping me afloat. I was very young, and it was really a shock to the system, and I'm the one who found him in the street. He had died. It was really a hard time being the baby in the family and being the one to have to tell everyone in the family that he was gone, including my mom. So that was a very hard time. But I remember being someone who was not into magical thinking at all, but having this very strange experience. And if my friend Mindy is listening, she can attest to this, because she was often out with me when this would happen in the months after he passed. I would see people who looked like him. And there were a couple times it would happen so often, we'd be out somewhere and she would say, "That person looks just like your dad, or has a voice just like your dad." I saw him everywhere.
Yeah.
And she would say, "Go over and talk to that person." I'd say, "No," and she would. "You know, you remind my friend." she was very comforted by that. And so I would end up talking to these people, and some of them were a little freaked out, and some of them were very kind and said, "Oh, I'm so glad that I could be here to help you with this moment and feel connected." And that was really lovely and generous of them, even if, you know, they believed or they thought we were nuts, whatever it was. But what was so interesting was that after a period of time, I no longer saw him everywhere because I didn't need to.
Didn't need to, yeah.
And so that's that, he was more integrated into me and into my mind, but not into my daily life, where I was used to seeing his face. So as my needs shifted and as my acceptance shifted, my experiences around me also shifted, and what I saw was different. And that was fascinating to me because I realized that I saw what I needed to see because I needed it.
Yeah.
And I was used to it.
My relationship with death has changed dramatically since those since my younger days. Mm-hmm. And it's odd to me that I would be more comfortable with it the closer I got to it and more afraid of it when I was young. Mm-hmm. It's just strange to me.
I mean, I think I understand. I mean, you know, it's a shock to the system when you're young and you think that your whole future is before you and right. you're not thinking about it ending. I think something to go back to your activism, you use this great phrase, and I wrote it down, grief vampire. And so there is, yes, we can shift from talking about grief to talking about the vampires. I mean, the people who are parasitic, the people who feed off of other people's trust and love and pain. And sadness and fears. And that, you know, I think that fuels a lot of people to do this kind of work, this kind of activist work. And so I'm wondering about that for you, if it was the vampire part that got you.
It was actually the alt-med charlatans that really fueled me with having the HIV denialism is still around. It's not very pronounced anymore. I mean, anti-vax stuff is far more damaging right now. There are a lot of quacks out there who promote just crazy, like, don't even get me started on Goop. That just makes me mental. Oh, I can't even handle that. A rich fool and their money are soon parted. But all of that kind of stuff, I'm angry about it, and I want to like be an activist, and at the same time I have a lot of compassion for the believer because they're afraid.
Exactly.
And they don't even know they're afraid. I would not have told you people, and I'm at Skeptical and other events, people come up to me and said, well, what would have changed your mind back then? I'm an activist. I want to know what would have changed your mind. And I can tell you, nothing would have changed my mind. I would not have changed my mind. It would have locked me in more. I would have gotten more like, yeah, really? Mm-hmm. I know that because people would come at me. I mean, I sat there and listened to the head of HIV medicine try to talk my friend into taking these drugs. And even that didn't sink in to me. I just thought she was being mean. She was being compassionate and she was heartbroken. As after he passed away, as gracious to me as you could imagine, because she knew I was in pain.
Right.
But she also knew I sat in the other room, and I didn't try to talk him into taking the drugs, because I totally believed Peter Duisberg, and I totally believed Christine Maggiore, who was an HIV denialist who died of AIDS, and her daughter died of AIDS, and they still denied that happened. Oh, well, she died of this and her daughter only had meningitis or whatever. No, she had, they did autopsies. She had HIV. It was not a thing. So while it's still sort of a fringe denialist thing, there are a lot of things out there that really fueled my activism around quackery and made me really happy to be able to work for the James Randi Educational Foundation. And I met a lot of great people like the Novella brothers who do Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, which is a brilliant podcast. I work with them on their brand and their design work. And David Gorski, who is a cancer surgeon who has Respectful Insolence, which is a really great blog about quackery and just despicable behavior. But that's the thing about science. It's self-correcting, always self-correcting. Mm-hmm. Even with John Ioannidis' papers about lots of peer-reviewed stuff, is there's chicanery going on with that. And it's, but we know it because we eventually figure it out because other scientists have to peer review it. And you know, follow the money and follow the power. You know, those are two things that I think scientists don't do. One thing James Randi did was something called Project Alpha, in which he hired these two magician. He got two of his magician proteges, these young guys, a guy who goes by the name of Banachek now, who is a great magician, and another young man. And he had them go to some scientists, I think it's Stanford, claiming that they were psychic and had telekinesis abilities. And they totally fell for it. They absolutely fell for it. And James Randi kept going, "Are you sure you don't want me in there to show you all the, you know, to the scientists? I should be in there with doing the protocol for you." And they're like, no, they totally fooled these scientists. And they just use simple tricks, simple magic tricks, because the scientists couldn't believe someone would do that. They couldn't believe they'd be unethical.
Right.
That's the astonishing thing, mm-hmm. is that scientists are trained in reason and logic, and they don't understand it when somebody does crazy, illogical stuff.
Right.
Because they're not looking for it. They're not expecting it. And that's the thing about magic, where if you learn magic and misdirection and sleight of hand, then there's lessons to be learned there. For everyone, whether you're applying for a loan or buying a car or, you know, shopping for a vacuum or something online, mm-hmm. critical thinking serves you all the time. I'll get off my soapbox.
No, your soapbox is a good one, and I'll climb up there with you once in a while, because I think we have a lot to talk about and commiserate about, and I think that. When you were talking about what fueled your activism, I mean, you know, there could be a lot of things that fuel it, but one of the things is sort of what you were talking about when you were talking about the scientists, that they couldn't believe that people would be doing this, would be trying to trick other people because they're so fact-based and it has to be honest and true. And so I see kind of the wreckage of people who were trusting and good and kind and honest and believed that because that's the way they operate in the world, that that's the way other people were going to be with them. That, you know, what happens to them when someone just completely takes advantage of that? And yes, it is a bit of a different story when the person who takes advantage of that really does believe. I try to give them more of a pass, you know, when they're just kind of out there and they really have convinced themselves of it.
Yeah.
But when someone knowingly does this to someone else, that is what gets me.
That's like, you would know the exact term for that. I don't know if it's sociopathy or psychopathy, but it's out there. I had a long relationship with somebody who suffered from borderline personality disorder in my youth. And that's an amazing personality disorders are not well understood by the lay public, I don't think. And yet everyone knows someone with a personality disorder.
Yeah.
I guarantee you.
Right.
And some of them are in positions of enormous power right now around the world.
True.
I'm sure there are, you know, I don't know how many kinds of human being there are. I admit there's only like 10 kinds of human beings. If you want to, I don't know what it would be. I'm sure in psychology and it's people are broken down into all kinds of behaviors and clusters of behaviors. And I know that personality disorders are disagreed on in the DSM even. It's like, they change the parameters of it, and they argue at conferences, and they come up with improved versions of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, people do not always have your best interest at heart, and sometimes people are very broken and will do anything to make a living. And if they believe they can sell ionized water, which is just tap water. And it's not hurting anybody. It's not hurting anybody. Right. I'm just charging $10 a bottle the craze for raw water. That's wonderful. Uh-huh. Raw water.
Yeah.
I mean, think about you. Try to use my powers for good.
Just pictured you with this cape waving in the wind. So I support you using your powers for good. And
I try.
I support all people who do that, who want to be out there on the front lines, and not for themselves, you know, because there's a lot that you do that I'm finding out about that is behind the scenes, which is actually a really lovely thing. So there's a lot more that you've done than people know about or might ever know about.
I have a fairly healthy ego, and I like being acknowledged for stuff, but you know, sometimes I know it does not need to be about me. It really shouldn't be about me. It should be about the thing I'm trying to help people with. There are so many people that are taken advantage of in the world. Mm-hmm. And the one thing about being a critical thinker and trying to be a critical thinker, because my critical thinking is something that I will be learning to do for the rest of my life. And my magical thinking will never go away. Every time I see a light in the sky, I want it to be an alien. Mm-hmm. Every time I...
Because that would be awesome.
It's always the first thing that comes to my mind is the magical cause of something. It doesn't matter what it is. A black cat will run across and I have to let go. It's a black cat. Okay, 13 isn't going to hurt me. I can walk under the ladder.
Right.
One thing that always cracks me up is I always use Siri. I'm like, Siri, call my mother. And I call Joan Coleman. And Siri goes, calling Joan Coleman home. And I was, first time I heard that, it's like, oh, that's bad luck because they're calling her home. I was like, oh, really? It's a machine that you're talking to, and it doesn't even have really a brain. Come on. it's superstition like that, that it doesn't go away just because you're a critical thinker. I have to pause for a second and go, oh right. Yeah, I remember I used to be freaked out about things like that.
But I think that there is something so honest about that, that we want certain things to be true.
Oh, I do. I still want things to be true. I still want mind-body dualism to end up being a thing, and I fly around the universe after I die and check out the cloud tops of Saturn and see life on other planets and hang out with my friends forever. I mean, mm-hmm. that would be cool, but right. I don't think the evidence leans that way.
Right.
And I have accepted that not knowing I don't exist. It's going to be just like 1958 for me, or 57.
Right.
It'll be just like 1957 for me. That's all I can say. Because I was born in 1959.
Right. So. I figured that was meaningful.
I've been dead for much longer than I've been alive. If you want to think about it that way.
Ooh, that's a really interesting way to see it.
I've been dead for 14.5 billion years. And I get this little, my belief is, my passion is that I get this little window to look out into the most amazing universe you could possibly imagine. Mm. And that we have consciousness is astonishing. That consciousness evolved on this planet is so cool. Mm. Does it evolve everywhere? I don't know. I used to automatically think I grew up with Star Trek and Lost in Space and Battlestar Galactica and Star Wars. So I just kind of always had that, of course it's everywhere. But, you know, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's really rare. And to waste it fearing Armageddon, or to waste it toiling away in the basement of the Cedars of Lebanon building under Scientology, or to waste it in a fearing hell is heartbreaking to me. But to be in awe of the moon, and to be in awe of the tides, and to be brought to tears by bats flying out of the Congress Street Bridge, or to love astronomy, or to love all the people around you, that is the incredible gift we have. And my sense of wonder multiplied so much once I let go of magical thinking that it became more precious to me.
Beautiful. Okay. That's fantastic. Okay. I don't know what to say. It's just, it's kind of delicious. All right. So good to talk to you, to learn from you, to appreciate that you are an unsung or only partially sung hero.
Oh, it's my view through this little set of monkey eyes here that I get to look out into the world through. And I know there are 7.5 billion other people with equally valuable, equally amazing worldviews. And I can't be in judgment of whether they're doing it right or wrong. Right. I mean, I might say so, but I can't make them bad or wrong for it, you know?
Right. Okay. Okay. So good to speak with you. Thank you for your time and your insights. And I hope we get to talk again soon.
Yeah, that would be good. There are other subjects I would probably want to cover someday.
So yeah, let's definitely do that.
Okay.
I'll pencil you in till whenever.
Great.
That'd be awesome. Okay, good.
Thanks, Rachel.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
As promised, I want to give you an update on Alan and Dee. I did an episode a little over a year ago called Home Invasion about a couple who had a man named Randy move into their house and take over their lives in every way. And a lot of people remembered the story for a lot of reasons, but especially because of the notes that Alan and Dee started sending back and forth to each other as a way to communicate when they weren't allowed to talk to each other in their own home. Randy made sure of that. They've saved their notes. They're still buried in a box in the yard of the house that they sold. And they have digital copies, so they will have it as a memory always. And Randy's still in jail. And what's incredible is that he has a following in jail. He is so calculating and so masterful, unfortunately, at being charismatic and making people think that he has wisdom beyond anyone else. And he's also intimidating, so people feel the need to have to listen to him, even in jail. And Alan has continued to do voiceover work, and that's why he's not doing this update, because he now has a recognizable voice and wants to keep some privacy. And Dee has one more year of school to become a teacher. So they sold their house, and they were going to buy a new one, but they decided they weren't ready. They felt like they needed a little more therapy under their belts to be able to really feel secure and safe and protect their home. And so they're renting for now until they feel stronger. And because they have some post-traumatic stress, understandably, from their experience, they're both going to therapy, and Alan attends a men's group where he learns a lot about how to stand up for himself and how to get over his fears of confrontation. I saw them at a local conference here in LA that I was running, and I hope to see them again. And also, last time I gave you an update, they were expecting a baby. They had a baby. She's wonderful and 5 months old. And they're going to do everything they can to teach her how to keep herself safe in this world. One more thing before you go. I was struck by my conversation with Kernan. Of course, he is one of these unsung heroes and does a lot of things, a lot of really good and powerful things from behind the scenes. And we've known of each other for a long time, but haven't had an opportunity to talk. And so I was really happy about being able to do so today and then share my conversation with you. He used a term that I really liked called New Agery. And it was so good because there's so many terms that just have become part of our lexicon that at time meant nothing and then meant something. And then when you play with it, you realize it also kind of means nothing, because what does it mean to be New Age? Everything. Or the next thing is New Age. And so it's fine for me to call it New Agery. And then I started thinking about some of the ideas that I come across in my work. And I was going over some of my notes from calls I had received and emails and clients I had heard from. And they might actually refer to something, but that something might not be anything real. It's very trippy. It's very interesting. And it's interesting work. If anyone wants to do it, please let me know. But going over my notes, here's just a brief list I came up with some of the terms that I had heard recently. Scanning, new thought, A Course in Miracles. That's been around for a while. The idea of mindfulness. It's a good idea, I suppose, although it's been so used and overused that now it kind of doesn't mean very much of anything, but a lot of people are making money off of it. The idea of human crystallization, DNA reformation, hallucinogenic activation, spiritual healing, masters of the ancient, transformational vibrations, anything Atlantis, Atlanteans, or also Aquarian, anything Aquarian, planetary energy alignment, harmonic convergence, ascended masters, mediums, quantum anything, actually, that isn't science, like quantum mysticism, neo-shamanism, automatic writing, enlightenment, whatever that kind of means, state of being, suspended beingness, soul purpose mapping, raising your frequency, Bettelheim autism cures, the lizard people, astral everything also, astral communication, astral projection, astral connectivity, etc. And Dianetics, body thetans, the purification rundown, unfortunately, sexual corrections can only, well, I won't get into that. That's very disturbing. Sexual purification, also disturbing. Sexual manifestation, just not ever quite sure what that means, but it's usually inappropriate and wrong. Primal scream therapy, medical intuition, NLP, and all of the controversy around that. Psychic surgery, astrological retrograde reversal. Yep, that's a thing. I don't know what it is, but it's a term. Channeling, rebirthing, clouding, pseudo-archaeology, remote viewing, phrenology, bilocation, electronic voice phenomenon, white sounds, psychometry, middle realm awareness, thought field therapy, power spots, tapping, neural balancing. Oh, and also this last one that I heard about, that meth kills the flu. Don't try that at home. I'm sure it's not true. It might, but it kills a lot of other things too. And while this list is long, it is a tiny percentage of the cures, the therapies, the ideas, theologies, and marketing ideas out there. They're all ideas clients have shared with me, and I'm not the only one in this field, so I can only imagine how many ideas there are floating around out there. And so if a new client says they have come to believe that ferrets run the universe from underwater habitats submerged in the Bermuda Triangle, and I don't react, that's why. Out there, ideas don't kind of shock me anymore. They sometimes intrigue me, sometimes disturb me, but they don't shock me. And I found that sometimes the ideas are less important anyway to me than the real reasons that this is all a problem to me. First of all, sometimes people die. They are taught to believe what they're told instead of taking their medication, told to bathe in specially blessed water instead of needing to continue with their chemotherapy. It's irresponsible, it's dangerous, it's malpractice, and it's morally reprehensible and repugnant, again, to me. And they don't resist the encouragement sometimes to commit suicide in some of these organizations because they're told they're not killing themselves. They'll just be shedding their corporal selves and living on again. It also bothers me because none of these terms can be fully understood or defined, so you never really know what it all means, and then you can't really get an accurate sense of it, a grasp of it, to find out if it has any veracity or accuracy or validity, or if it's even a thing at all. These ideas usually come with a price tag, too, and you often need to pay to get this information and this enlightenment, this treatment, this training, have this transformational moment. And it gives people false hope, and it wastes their time and resources, and is built on a foundation that promotes magic while it inhibits research and finding out the truth. And as you heard in my conversation with Kernan, I understand the wish for magic. Sometimes I wish it really did exist. I understand the need to believe what you've thought was impossible before because it's empowering, it's hopeful, it's soothing, and it just feels really good. Maybe there are people who truly believe these ideas and feel they are providing others with tools and cures and insights that they just can't get anywhere else. And that's all right as long as you don't keep teaching these new agery ideas after seeing that they are at best something that has had a zero impact on someone, but at worst have put people's bodies and their minds at risk knowingly. But there have always been a plethora of snake oil salesmen, an endless stream of them, in fact, and there always will be. And you don't have to be afraid of it or avoid everything out there. And there are some ideas, admittedly, that sounded nuts at first, and they turned out to be great and valid. Plenty of Fun was made originally of the ideas of antibiotics, seasonal affective disorder, mosquitoes carrying malaria, continental drift, that there is this thing called a germ and this thing called genetics, and that there would ever be space flight, and also traumatic brain injury and concussions from sports injuries. And also that learning disabilities are not necessarily correlated with IQ. That seemed to be new information for a lot of people. Every once in a while, I go to a group meeting, to a healer, to other people and places I've heard about just to check it out for myself. And I know that I will really be able to then see kind of firsthand what these people are talking about, but I also know that I'm not going to see it all. A lot of things are saved for people who are in the upper levels, people who kind of have been fully initiated. That's when they really see what's happening behind the scenes. But I've sat patiently through a ton of word salad. It doesn't bother me. It kind of fascinates me. And what I notice too is the people nodding their heads yes in the room as though they somehow understand this. And there are people who get up in front of people and will speak endlessly but say nothing. And again, I can handle it, and I even write some of them down. Like when a workshop leader was asked one time by a not fully convinced participant, "So why do we need to come back if you just told us that you've given us all the tools we need for a better life?" And the workshop leader said, "Because your mind is feeling satisfied, but your soul is asking that question. And until you can align your soul with your mind, you're not done." That actually didn't convince him. And he's looked at his watch and said, "Gotta go." But the other people in the room were nodding again their heads yes. Like somehow that made sense. People don't want to have their spiritual or emotional or psychological parties crash. And I can also handle when a healer tells me to stand up while he's doing his healing so the energy can run all the way through me from my third eye down to the core of the earth, whatever that means, and it's not measurable, and so I go along with it. It doesn't hurt me. I can even tolerate, and this is all just collect data about these people. I can even tolerate the instruction by kind of a mystical coach to listen with the dance of possibility. That's an actual quote. And when he said that to me, there was a long pause and a meaningful gaze into my eyes. And I remember thinking that I was in a cartoon, and if there had been a thought bubble, I would have said in that thought bubble, "You know, the thing that you just said doesn't make sense, right?" But esoteric doesn't equal evolved. And trippy doesn't equal true. And unprovable doesn't prove, well, anything. But what I can't handle are the people who will say, "I sense something is very wrong with you, and you need to pay for my services to keep you safe or even alive or someone you love alive." Or the therapists or others who say that if you can't remember a particular horrific abuse event in your childhood, that just proves that it's true. And then the ever popular, "It doesn't matter what I do to you or what I have done to you and what others might think is wrong that I've done to you. Your only problem is that you feel anger about it, and that's something that I need to help you with." And when you hear those sorts of things, I want you to hear them through a filter, through an internal translator that can actually translate what that message means. That it's not that your anger is the issue. It's the person saying to you, "I want to make sure that I get away with everything, and I can do anything to you, and I can rely on you not resisting. I was one time quoted in an article about a mystical group, and a lot of people had been hurt in this organization. And they asked me for some quotes about it, and I shared some ideas that I'd gotten from the people who had come to see me. And the last line in this article was a quote from someone who represented the organization who said, "All of the things that Rachel Bernstein just said just prove why we are necessary. Just prove that because there are people out there who are so negative, who are so away and distant from the light of goodness, that we need to be here to balance out that energy. We need to be here to be the light." So Rachel is the one who proves why we are needed, because she is so disturbed, and we need to help purify the people out there who are so disturbed. And so it didn't bother me, but I'm sharing it with you because if you're ever in a situation where you have spent your time or you've given your trust to an organization that gives you the sort of pseudo mystical version of, "I know you are, but what am I?" It's time to go. These people are not worth your time. They don't treat you respectfully, and they don't take responsibility, and you deserve better. Talk to you next week.
Indoctrination is available for download on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, and more. Please support Indoctrination at patreon.com/indoctrination. Subscribers receive bonus episodes, interviews, and other cool goodies. Send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. Thank you for your support. And if you can't become a paid subscriber, I will be so grateful for any and all support that you show. Whether it's subscribing on SoundCloud, YouTube, or Patreon, or giving us a like on our Indoctrination Facebook page, or following our Twitter and Reddit feeds. Thank you for keeping up with us and for keeping the show going. Until next time, Rachel.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.